Salam to all of you. When Begin visits Cairo, we will say shalom. On an occasion such as this, I would like to approach the topic of Egypt and the present journey of Anwar Sadat, not in terms of a finished explanation of a fulfillment of prophecy, but in terms of the background and long-range events of the future that no one else perhaps could give from the same perspective as I might, because of my own experiences both in the area and in history, and of course our reading of the Bible. Mr. Gene Hogberg, perhaps at some future time, who's in the News Bureau, will be able to address this question with some insight that presently we might not altogether have, because it has happened so suddenly. We do not assume that every event of unusual nature on the world scene should have to be described in detail any more than Neville Chamberlain's visit to Adolf Hitler, when in returning to England he said that there will be peace in our time. Unfortunately, his clock moves faster than most, it seemed, and it ran out within a year. In this case, we have a most unusual experience of an Egyptian suggesting that he would be willing to travel to Jerusalem. You know, there's never been such a record of a ruler of Egypt since ancient days who ever visited Jerusalem. There was a queen of the south who visited Solomon, but since that time we have no such record. Just a little bit to offer as a suggestion: Anwar Sadat is not a pure Egyptian. He is half Sudanese and half Egyptian, to my knowledge. He is in some serious trouble in Egypt itself because of the impact of the far left. And I would point out that the reason Anwar Sadat made this trip so quickly, having been encouraged by the President of the United States and accepted by the Israelis, is the fact that if he waits too long, he may never return to Egypt, because his enemies will destroy him. He has moved so fast in the Israeli manner that it is likely he will return to Egypt safely. I think that if you do your duty, if I do my duty and the responsibility here today, it is always, of course, for anyone who speaks, a responsibility and a privilege. I think our duty is to go from here and to keep our eyes open in a way we have not been doing, because we have had them on other things. But suddenly there is a shift from South Africa, Rhodesia area, or your own personal problems, to something now that indeed is in the news as unusual. Anwar Sadat had a background that reflected something of the difference between Egyptians and Sudanese in his thinking, and I will mention just a little bit about that later. But you should know something of the man, and you should learn a little something of the country. There will be later, of course, a very glamorous display of the antiquities of Egypt when the remains of the tomb of Tutankhamun that are being sent abroad will be here also, I think, in Southern California. And I will leave this up to the newspaper to define time and place. But indeed, we have been for many years looking to the Middle East for the events that are prophesied in the Bible, but it seemed when an explosion was about to occur, as it did in 1967, then the focus became blurred and the problem seemed to have dissipated. Momentarily revived in 1973, and here we are in 1977. How soon this little bubble on the world scene will come and go remains to be determined. But we want to take a broader, longer look at some things today that perhaps will put things in perspective for us. In a sense, we're going to take a look at some parts of prophecy and history that will help us better understand. My first experience in the Middle East was in 1957, which is 20 years ago. I would like to tell you a bit about it, because some of the books you will find on the library shelves are written from a perspective of what it was like then. I have not been to the Arab countries other than Jordan, I guess. Oh, I forget now how circumstances are, but anyway, I have never been back to the Arab countries since that time, except, of course, one travels in what was then a part of Jordan, in now the state of Israel, which we call the West Bank. I think that's the way I would have to describe it. At that time, when I spent about 2 weeks in Egypt, which 1 week was in Lower Egypt alone, the average Egyptian man was never, ever seen in a Western business suit. He was only seen in the traditional garb, usually white. And women were seen with their faces nearly covered. In 1957, 20 years ago, Egypt was a land of the past. We rode on a train from Cairo to Upper Egypt. The train left early. I forget, was it? Was it the night before? I think it might have been. I don't remember now what the schedule was, but we were on the train in the black of night from Cairo. And we were moving toward Upper Egypt along the Nile. And by 5 in the morning, men and women and children were working the fields. This was in the summer. By 5 in the morning, the work was already begun. That meant that it was possible, you see, to have the hot noonday period for rest, and some evening work could occur. That gave you nearly 7 hours of work in the morning. Now, our world would be quite different, and then you could work from maybe 4 to 6 or 7 at night, and in the afternoon there would be rest. When we visited a little village called Baliana, en route back by rail, all these were essentially farming communities. We rested in a little hotel in which I was willing to sit and Dr. Meredith was only willing to stand. He felt that it might not be clean. I found no lice, no bed bugs as a consequence, but it did need a certain cleansing. We went out to the community restaurant, and the water that was served was from a large wooden tank that may have had 200 gallons. There was a community aluminum cup attached by a chain to the tank, and there was a little faucet. happen. Everyone, including myself, drank from the aluminum cup and was washed, and then the next person drank. We had a meal, and the dish on which the bit of chicken and macaroni were served, the dish was cracked and mended. But I never got sick, because I never ate where tourists were, in a fine hotel, where you get sick, because they try to act Western and they're not able to. Most people would not do what I did, and I'm not saying this is what you must do. What you must do is probably what you're going to do anyway, to go where the tourists are, or you will get sick. And someday, then, you will do what I do. Eat with the natives like a native. There is something to that that I think is too often overlooked. My guide was a Christian Copt, and I visited the Christian community outside Luxor in Upper Egypt. The book dealer had in his shop, this was 1957, most of the library books that belonged to the English who fled the country in 1956, to which I became heir. The book dealer, since no one at the moment was in his shop, was reading, not a dime novel, he was reading the Bible. And he is waiting, as the Copts are, for the return of Jesus Christ in a Muslim land. And their hope is this. Now a Copt looks a little bit different from the Egyptians that you will see in Cairo, who are mostly Muslim. But there isn't any doubt that there are great similarities between the older Egyptian stock and most of the Arabs who have come in, because after all they are descended as a whole from Ishmael, and Ishmael's mother was Arabic, and the wife that was chosen by the mother, I should say, was Egyptian. His mother was Egyptian and his wife, so the Arabs are three quarters Egyptian. But there isn't any question there are slight differences, just as much as there are within this country, between the American South and the rest of the land, as an illustration. It was interesting to know something of the character of an Egyptian. I've never had this experience in my life before. Like everything else, the first time you really travel abroad at length outside Europe, you discover that you run out of money. And I had no money for lunch that I told you about, and I had no money for a tip for my guide, who was Salib Hanna. He was a remarkable man, a man respected by Muslim and Christian alike. He said, "Look, I will pay for your meal." And I told him later I didn't have money for the tip. He said, "Look, I have served you and taken care of you. I know you, that you will take care of me." And I sent him a tip from Cairo via the postal system. And presumably it worked. Now this tells you something that I don't think we are really aware of in terms of the potential character and honor of people, because we hear the political side of things. Hearing only the political side, we lose something of the aspect of the character of the people. what it is 20 years later might not be the same as it was 20 years ago. But I found that there was honor that was very unusual. I cannot imagine this done by a guide in New York City, waiting till I got back to Los Angeles and also in the meantime buying me a meal. But it tells you something of why there is a little verse in the Bible, and we'll quickly turn to that, because what I'm dwelling on here is not the great industry of Egypt. It is something of the unusual character of the people, as my experience in one man made itself known. I think it is reflected also somewhat in the character of Anwar Sadat, to be willing to do what he has done. There is a time in Isaiah 19, verse 23, where there is to be a highway extending out of Egypt into the region that we now know as Iraq, crossing the Middle East. Assyria, at this point, is the ancient land that is, in modern terms, known as Iraq. And the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria. And the Egyptians shall serve with the Assyrians. Now in that day, Israel shall be the third of these three people mentioned, of which two are already, with Egypt and with Assyria. Now, Israel is today only essentially hardly more than one to two tribes. So there's going to be a significant migration of Israelites who were lost. There may even be Egyptians coming back to Egypt. And there certainly would have to be, on the basis of this, Assyrians coming back to Iraq. Now whom the Lord, I've skipped a part here. In that day shall Israel be the third, even a blessing in the midst of the land. Now, whom the Lord of hosts shall bless, blessing all three. And it says, blessed be Egypt, my people. Assyria, the work of my hands. Israel, my inheritance. An interesting parallel. One, a people who make a religion out of work. The other, who are in fact what God has inherited, and in a sense he gave them his inheritance, something he set aside for a particular people he will choose. But here, in special way, we have a reference to Egypt. And Egypt is spoken of in a word that you might say it has no meaning, and yet I think it has special meaning. Blessed be Egypt, my people. Now, when God speaks of his people, he speaks of them in very human terms. Not in terms of skills or ability, but in terms of character. Of all the people of the earth, the British have said that there are the two that are most obnoxious. Now, if any of you descend from either of these, please understand this is a generalized British view, having run an empire and the Commonwealth. One is the Egyptian and the other is an Indian from India. What is this that makes an Egyptian on the one hand so obnoxious, and yet on the other so remarkable that God could single them out of the people of the Middle East in terms of being a special people, which is certainly an emphasis on character? I had an experience with a guide in Cairo after we returned. I visited the museum, and the guide came to me and showed me the museum. I tipped him. Later on, I wanted to go back to the museum and just look at it in peace by myself. And the guide spotted me, and I told him that I wanted to, but he would never listen. He was like the dragoman that Herodotus had to deal with. They were no different in Herodotus' day, in the days of Ezra, than they are today. When they are carnal and trying to serve you for money, it is a stress because you cannot get rid of them. They are there. They will walk with you. They will help you and show you this and that, even when you don't need it. What is lacking is the wisdom to know how to serve another. But what is there very clearly in the character of the Egyptian is a people who have a willingness to think of and to serve others. It was expressed in the case of a Christian Copt who knew how to do it right, and another man who didn't know how to do it right in terms of our standard of judgment, please. The Christian Copt, Salih Bakhana, saw that unlike most tourists, I was trying to understand what I saw. And I stayed behind and looked. And he waited before going on, or he may have offered some other explanation in the meantime, but he always waited till I was satisfied, and Dr. Meredith, with what we saw. He was a most thoughtful and unusual person. When it was all over, he not only expected, you see, that I would take care of him, he gave me 2 volumes from his library as a gift with his own signature, from which he learned the history of Egypt. I've never had a guide ever do this in all my life. And I think it tells you something of the character of the people whose leader today, half Egyptian, half Sudanese, has been willing to go to Jerusalem to tell something of what he calls the Arab cause. There he will talk. Whether in English or Arabic, I don't know, as of the time that I last listened to news. He will also pray, and I think it is defined as the Al-Aqsa Mosque that he will go to tomorrow. He will visit what is certainly the Jewish memorial, the Yad Vashem. Am I getting the name right? I think that is it. The history of the Jews in Europe. It will, without a question, be a tremendous experience. So much so that since indeed Egypt has led the whole of the Arab world and is by nature its leader because it has such a large population and it has a continuity of culture. You look at the other countries, the size may be different, but there is no Nile in Jordan. There is no Nile in Saudi Arabia. There may be icebergs later, but that's something else. The Saudis would like to bring some icebergs so they have some fresh water. Now, none of these countries has the capacity that Egypt does. The problem, of course, is that Egypt lacks the potential of oil as it now is. Anyway, it is interesting to see an analysis of the character of the people in a long-range prophecy, the willingness of this man, and the general state of affairs and the attitude of other Arab nations. Now, there are different kinds of minds in the Arab world. There is a kind of brotherhood that one senses immediately, and also something different. When I went to Khartoum on the way from Rwanda, Urundi to Cairo, we did not have an entry visa, and we were not allowed to stay in the country except overnight. But I did engage in a discussion with the people there. Now, the Sudan, or the Republic of the Sudan, lies south of Egypt, and Anwar Sadat is half Sudanese. These people were far more disciplined in terms of their leadership, in my estimation, than those that I met in Egypt. Numeri, who is the leader, may reflect the same thing. But they are a significantly disciplined people at the top. I asked the Sudanese, what is your ancestry? What is your descent? And their comment was very simple. We are the true Egyptians. The others down there, most of them in the lower Nile, north of us, are newcomers. We are the true Egyptians, was his word. And he was black. But he was black with an Arab face. Would never be taken for a Negro of West Africa in the traditional sense. He was Arabic in his appearance, but black-skinned, and this will tell you something of Herodotus' statement. Herodotus said that the Egyptians of his day were black. Now, they weren't all black. But those who were true Egyptians were. And what Herodotus, of course, didn't discern is that the tradition of the Egyptians, who are those people who descend with this name, Koptos, is that they are indeed not descendants of Mitzrayim, they are descendants of Cush. Because if you will look in the Greek tradition, you will discover that it is the family of Cush that gave the name Egypt to the land of Mitzrayim. And they have lived in Upper Egypt, and the Mitzrites in Lower Egypt. The Mitzrites, of course, got this name so that outside of the Arabic world and through the Greek world, we call everybody an Egyptian. But there were two peoples along the Nile in the south and upper Egypt, or Nubia, were Cushites. And in the north, or lower Egypt, you have to look at a map to know why I'm defining it this way, were the Mitzrites, who descended from Mitzrayim. In this sense, Anwar Sadat is a combination of the two stocks. But the bulk of the people whom we know as Arabs are descendants from the family of Shem through Abraham and the family of Mitzrayim, and differ from a branch of the people who were known as Egyptians, but who descend from another stock altogether, the family of Cush. When I went to Jordan, which was the next country, we there saw something else of human character in these people. I was distressed after I perceived what I saw. There was little doubt that the people who live in the Hashemite kingdom of Jordan, which certainly involved at that time descendants of the people of Moab and Ammon and other stocks, and who live in the region of Sodom and Gomorrah, that's the only place in the Arab world I saw men holding hands with other men. I thought this was really a friendly country at first, until I perceived that it was not only friendliness, but there was also a problem that apparently has been in this people as a whole from the days that Lot's daughters decided to have children by their father, an idea that they certainly must have acquired through contact with the peoples of Sodom and Gomorrah and Zoar and the other communities. Nevertheless, I met responsible people in the country. It doesn't mean that everybody is alike in these lands. There are criminals, there are great and noble individuals. But the country was then very greatly divided between Palestinian Arabs and the peoples who came into the land with King Hussein's family. You perhaps should realize at this point, and many of you who know the history of the area will understand that I'm only touching on the subject. King Hussein is the only man on the throne in the Middle East who descends from Muhammad of the tribe of Kedar. He has a distant relative who is the leader of Morocco, who also in the West descends from Muhammad. Prior to the establishment of the Republic in Iraq, there was a branch and a cousin of the family of King Hussein, but the rebels destroyed him. This family arose from the region of the Hejaz on the west coast of Saudi Arabia that we now know, or the Arabian Peninsula. The Saudis do not descend, that is the family that rules this region of Arabia, of many tribes, they come from the family of Saud. And this branch does not come from Muhammad, but through connivings with the British, came to dominate the Arabian Peninsula, and the line of Muhammad was left to find a place which was carved out for them in the region that we call then Transjordan and now the Heshemite Kingdom of Jordan, from the family of Shem or Hashem, not the Shem of the Bible, but a later descendant, of course. So you have Arabs of the family of Kedar actually ruling in Jordan. You have Palestinian Arabs, most of whom are the bulk of people who were once east of the land and have come west, Moab and Ammon, though that doesn't mean that all Moabites and Ammonites are in that country. I think surely some have migrated out to Europe, just as, for that matter, Israelites and Assyrians have, or Egyptians. In order to get to Jordan, we did have to fly first from Cairo to Damascus. And when we were in Damascus, we did want to make a quick trip to the Jordanian side of Jerusalem then. This was in 1957. We asked, since we were going to take a limousine, what are we going to do with our luggage? The man in the hotel said, don't be concerned, leave it here, we will protect it. We decided to trust the Arab keeper of the hotel. When we got back, our luggage was there exactly where we left it days before, during which we had visited Amman, Jerusalem, Ma'an, and Petra. I can remember one day we spent coming back from Europe with Mr. Herbert Armstrong and then Mr. Hunting in Buffalo, New York. And by next morning, Mr. Hunting's room had been robbed. But that's the United States. I was in an Arab country where my luggage was regarded as safe because they had an honor. And I think that you need to understand some part of this character of the people, because we hear the rest of the story, which is all too true. The political propaganda, the inability of a people to discern politically what is good for them or their neighbors. I won't go any further into this picture. I could say something of similar experiences in Iraq as well as in Lebanon. And in each area, I found a different kind of people without any question. The level and the standard of living may best be described 20 years ago by my experience in a hotel in Nasiriyah near ancient Ur of the Chaldees. Women do not travel with men if they are Arabs in this part of the world. That is 20 years ago. Today, women are not only without the veil, they're getting some education. But 20 years ago, only men traveled. And European women who were treated as men. And we went into a little hotel after it had been 140 degrees outside. I thought it was 125. It was killing me. And that's the time, you know, that we were also traveling in August, and it was a fast day in the month of Ramadan, and you don't eat during the day. I didn't fully realize it was, but since I was an infidel, I was allowed to drink a bit before sunset. And after the fellow left, I went back to get some more water. I was a little thirsty. And I discovered two spigots. And I didn't know which one to take, so I was thirsty and took the closest one. Was a little unusual looking, but I drank it and didn't get sick. I asked the fellow later who operated the hotel which spigot I should use. He said, "You want to use this one over here," which is the one I didn't use. And he said, "This other is the wash water." So I normally use the other afterward for drinking. But it didn't seem to matter. We had a little room that night. It was separated from a central cubicle. Each room had an open front, and there was a little fan. There was a wall on either side and a wall in the back. There were no windows, but the front was open to the main cubicle where everybody could come and go, and there was chicken wire on the front. And there was a little cot. And this is the way you go to Nasiriyah's Hilton. And now the floor in the middle must be swept. And since they're so near the river Euphrates, and who wants to raise dust with a broom, they just get a bucket of water and swish the floor. And of course, that cools it. And we decided to dine, so we went to the marketplace and got a watermelon because there were no restaurants. We took the watermelon and cut it open with a long knife that was on the table, and there was a large aluminum plate. And our evening meal was the watermelon. Now, earlier that evening, I had sat down at a little marketplace, and I found that they had there buttermilk. And I was thirsty after sunset, and we sat on the ground in the market, just around the marketplace, and I drank buttermilk out of the bottle. And then what I found out was that this was the ritual. Here was the bucket of buttermilk, and here was the bucket of water. And here was the soapy water, so that they t- took the glass when you were finished it, the bottle, and put it in the soapy water and then dipped it in the other and then ladled the buttermilk out and put it in the freezer, the deep freeze, you know, that kept it cool. And then when you wished it, you got the buttermilk. And all this was done on the sand. It was on the ground. This was 20 years ago. Today, what I thought, for instance, in Iran, when we visited Tehran, was a kingdom of mud, is now a modern city. What I thought were hovels in Amman, Jordan, would now be reflective of a modern city. Oil in 20 years has so changed the face of the Middle East that we could not discern the difference as of the same people. It's as if you are in a different world. You can go out into the country, of course, and the old is much the same. But without any question, there were no modern houses in Amman. There were no paved streets in the city, and just a highway, briefly, that the Americans had built only recently. Now there is another side to the temperament of the people. We were at LG after we had left Ma'an on the way to Petra. And it was about 8 o'clock in the morning, and the two Arab policemen that were doing duty in the area were riding on their horses out of the stockade. Now the first thing apparently policemen do in this part of the world, after they have ridden out of the stockade to their daily duty, is to shoot at each other. That's another side of the Arab mind. Reminded me of an experience later in 1963 that I had the last day I was in the Israeli side of Jerusalem when I attended Hebrew Union College, the School of Archaeology. That morning, there was an exchange of gunfire between Arabs and Israelis. It started on the Arab side when the Arabs early in the morning began firing at each other. And they didn't see any reason why they shouldn't then turn the guns on the other side. There was no other provocation but that just somebody temperamentally took this kind of action. It is interesting to note, you see, that in a world of remarkable human concern is also a streak of political insanity. Political insanity that leads and will lead to the terrible crisis that is coming. That is, in a sense, normally an inability to come to terms with reality and to work things out for the best. I offered our guide, who was a man of the family of Moab by his own family tradition, a Christian, in the Heshemite kingdom of Jordan, a tip. That is, he was a guide who took us in a little car all the way up to Samaria and back. And he was going to meet us the next day, and it was going to cost so much, and we were going to pay him finally on the last day. But in the meantime, you know, like you learn in Africa where we had first been, because the British brought tipping there, I gave this man some money. And the next day, when he presented the final bill, I gave it to him as a tip. He actually had deducted my tip from the bill. He didn't keep it because it never occurred to him that one tips beyond what you charge as a legitimate price. And he refused a tip afterward. Now, in the land of Egypt, my fee was indeed whatever the generosity was. That was the way you did it there. The other man made a fixed figure because my Egyptian guide was hired by American Express. I wanted the best one in Egypt, and I think I got him. In Jordan, I hired a private man, so it was done differently. But you have this remarkable difference with respect to individual honor and also the strange temperament that reflects itself on the political horizon and with the use of weaponry just momentarily against each other unaccountably. I think you have to see both sides to understand the strength and the weakness in the Arab world. Today, we have a leader of Egypt whose prime minister resigned, whose second appointee resigned when he heard he was going to Jerusalem. This is a land filled with memories that are never to be forgotten. In the 1967 United Nations debate that brought supposed termination of hostilities and certainly not peace, as you know, in 1967 after the Six-Day War, the British and others who chaired the United Nations debate were so upset and distressed because the Arabs especially and the Israelis somewhat only kept bringing up irrelevant things. That is, irrelevant to the Western mind. But they were all relevant to the Eastern mind. The Arab pointed out that the Israelis who were coming into their world were not basically the Arab Jew who comes from Algeria and Morocco and Libya and Yemen and Iraq and Syria and Egypt. These were European Jews whose culture was different. And the primary argument in 1967 was very interesting. The Arab concern was not about the Jew in the Middle East. It was about the culture he was bringing from Europe and implanting in the Middle East. And it was an issue between the culture of Islam and the culture of the West. And this offended no small number of Europeans at the time, because they thought, what does our culture versus theirs have to do with settling a squabble along the borders between Jews and Arabs? I was so impressed that I ordered a transcript of the speech given by the representative of Saudi Arabia, which at that time we had put in our news bureau, because it illustrated without any question that the real issue of Zionism and of the State of Israel, as far as the Arab is concerned, involves one thing that a Westerner can't grasp. Now, it involves something else, too. But it involves the fact that it implants in the Middle East a state that has political ability to survive, bringing Western ideas to the European Jews in a land where the Arabs thought that they once had solved the problem when they finally drove the Crusaders out. They wrestled with this problem once before. And I think we need to see that from a European point of view, we want, let's say, a bit of the Middle East as European culture or Western culture.
We want this in an area that to the Christian world is in some way sacred, or as one of the brethren here mentioned to me, having seen the television program early this morning about the beginning of the trip of Sadat, she spoke of the holy city. Of course, I asked, you know, which one is that? But we think in the West, and not even excluding the church, as Jerusalem in some way is a holy city. And therefore, the whole Christian world, in a way, looks at it. And to an Arab, it is a holy city. The third in order, after Mecca and Medina. To a Jew, it is more than that. Now, I'm not giving the Israeli side of the story because I don't think that is the issue. I think we've had it presented many times. But I would like you to see what is behind the thinking of the Arab world as a whole. Now, at this time, the crisis in the Arab world is obvious, and that is that the Arabs have been torn by dissent through the centuries. The Saudi Arabian representative in 1967 said this was the weakness of the Arab world, that their people were divided. And every nation, every people and culture has its high points and its decline. And they admitted something we never would as a people. He said, our civilization has been at the low point. We decline. And he was willing to acknowledge it and realize it. I don't think the Western world would ever say so in their vanity today. And he said, who knows but what, you know, our civilization may bloom once again. But we can't have it bloom if we have this infestation of Western culture that is called the State of Israel. In the Middle East. That was the presentation. That was the Saudi Arabian presentation. This may not be the argument of some of the more liberal states, let's say in liberal in the political sense. They may be very extreme in one way in Iraq or in Syria. But the Arab world is very divided. And that's, of course, what the Bible would indicate, that by their very nature, that their hand would be against every man, and it's against each other as well as other people. The whole family is like this. Today, all we can do is to say that the United States is playing host to an unusual meeting. I would not draw the conclusion that there is any statement specifically that would explain this particular event. I don't know at this stage what the Israelis are willing to give. I don't know what the Arabs will have to expect in order to allow Sadat to stay there. Without trying to overthrow him. We have to watch these things. Hitler more than once came within a hair's breadth, as we say, from being assassinated. So did de Gaulle. But when the time has not arrived, there's nothing that can happen. But when the time arrives and God permits, it can be all over. I don't know how long Sadat will remain in power. I do know that the mind that this man has is not the mind that is described as the ultimate state of mind of Egyptians. And therefore, I draw a conclusion in any case that Sadat will not survive an appreciable length of time. If we are approaching the crisis at the close as a leader of his country, because Sadat is a man of his word. And Sadat is a significantly bold and sensible individual by any standard of the Arab world. There are some prophecies you might like to look at after the service sometime for the rest of the day. Especially a lengthy chapter, number 19 in Isaiah. First, however, I would want to go back and merely point up that there is a trend through Isaiah to record a series of prophecies and then to get to a point. And we have the story about Moab in chapter 15. That's certainly a part of the region of the Heshemite kingdom of Jordan, and a story about Damascus in chapter 17, which was one kingdom of Aram or Syria then, and some terrible things to befall that land. Damascus is ultimately to be destroyed, a ruinous heap, verse 1 of chapter 17. And then God's presence is certainly implied over and over again in these chapters that we have here in 15, 16, 17, and 18. Then in chapter 19 is a burden of prophecy on Egypt. The Lord rides upon a swift cloud and shall come into Egypt. Sometimes God did seem to intervene in times past. As Ezekiel will say, through the person of Nebuchadnezzar, you might read there Ezekiel 29 and any succeeding chapters on Egypt. But remember, Nebuchadnezzar was a type of the final ruler of Babylon. Now, at this time, when God intervenes, as he anciently did in Egypt, we have a state of affairs. Verse 2, that I will set the Egyptians against the Egyptians, and they shall fight everyone against his brother, and everyone against his neighbor, city against city, and kingdom against kingdom. Now, that's based on the antiquity of the country being subdivided and quarreling with itself instead of a united empire made up of separate kingdoms. And it's easy, of course, to have kingdoms within an empire. That was the whole history of Europe in the Middle Ages. In fact, Kaiser Wilhelm in the First World War was an emperor ruling over kingdoms in Germany. They're not normally discerned by the Westerner who hasn't gone back into history and realized the reality. But this would indicate that Egypt is going to go through, in the future, a state of civil strife. The spirit of Egypt shall fail in the midst thereof, and I will destroy its counsel, and they shall seek to, and here apparently, familiar spirits of various sorts. That is not a state of affairs at the moment. Egypt was once known as a land of wisdom. Sadat surely at this point in the whole Arab world conveys a certain measure of wisdom to go to meet someone who is an enemy and to try to talk it over and to explain your problem. But wisdom is to vanish. I will give the Egyptians over to the hand of a cruel lord, and a fierce king shall rule over them. He's not Egyptian, someone from the outside. And it's a time when the river Nile is going to be dried up. And the waters will not even get down, verse 6. And it's described further in that area. Then he describes some of the princes in antiquity of the city of Zoan in the eastern part of the delta of the city of Tanis in verse 11. You might compare them to the counselors of Pharaoh, the counselors of the ruler. They are fools. The counsel of the wise counselors of Pharaoh has become brutish. There is little doubt but what there are Egyptians who support him and Egyptians who do not. And the whole Arab world at this point is not in agreement. But in any case, God is picturing that the ultimate counselors and advisors in Egypt by any biblical standard behave as fools and are deceived. They have seduced Egypt. The Lord has mingled, verse 14, a perverse spirit in the midst thereof, and has caused Egypt to err in every work as a drunken person. Neither shall there be any work for Egypt which they will ever be able to accomplish, whether thought of by the head, the leader, or the tail, the man at the bottom. In that day shall Egypt be like a woman, and it shall be afraid and fear because of the shaking of the hand of the Lord of hosts, which implies the intervention of God in the day of the Lord, not the tribulation. At that time, the land of Judah will be a terror unto Egypt. Now, really, right now, there is a certain terror unto Egypt. And in that day is a very broad term. And the reason Sadat has gone to Jerusalem, is simple. You may not know, but it is true that most of the Arab states outside of Lebanon in the Middle East are more heavily armed today than Adolf Hitler's Germany was in 1939 when the Second World War began. The Israelis today are as heavily armed, of course, smaller population, as Germany was when Hitler began the war. What is in the Middle East today, if they were all combined, the Jews and the Arabs, would be a fighting force greater than was marshaled in all of Europe at the time of the Second World War by all the powers, population being an exception. I don't think we realize the tremendous number of tanks and airplanes that the Iraqis, the Iranians, the Syrians, the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, a little in Lebanon, and we're not even calling Turkey in this, that Transjordan or Jordan and Egypt have. The Middle East today is a tinderbox, and if you please, is the new Spain. Most of you will know, of course, that Spain was the testing ground of weaponry before the Second World War. Italy sent troops, volunteers, you know, always, and weaponry. The Germans sent weaponry. The Russians, the United States, and others, all the nations that could, offered volunteers or sold products to test their weaponry in the Civil War. They brought finally Francisco Franco to power in Spain. There is one reason we allowed Vietnam to be what it was. Brought out in the sermonette this morning, the state of mind of the people there must never be overlooked. You know, Vietnam was a test of the technology of our war without ever having to test it in a real war of any consequence. We learned more about how to improve our weapons there than we could ever have any other way. And the only reason we kept it going that long beside economics is so we could experiment with our weapons. And the Russians and the Chinese did the same. Now that that's over, we're experimenting in the Middle East once again. And the Egyptians are very concerned because the land of Judah is so heavily armed, even in contrast to the Arab world, that everyone that makes mention of it is afraid in himself. And Sadat has warned that a new struggle in the Middle East would be unbelievably terrible. That's the way he put it. It would be unbelievably terrible because, whereas before the tanks fought in the sands and the planes were bombed at the airports, the next time the nations know that their own cities with civilian population will be the targets as well. That's the state of affairs. And Sadat is a wise person and would like to resolve it as much as he can. Wisdom as far as God has given him. There is wisdom that comes from the Bible that he doesn't have. But in contrast to most political leaders, he's done something daring. And it's because of the counsel of the Lord of hosts which he has determined. And if Judah is a terror today, what shall it be tomorrow, so to speak? In that day also, Isaiah didn't know when all these things are coming, but he was told there's coming a time when these things will happen. And the order may not be absolutely clear, but it would seem that as a result of this, five cities in the land of Egypt will speak the language of Canaan, and Canaan's language was Hebrew. And swear to the Lord of hosts, one shall be called the city, and here it says of destruction, or the city of Heres, or the sun, which was ancient Heliopolis, which is old Cairo. This implies that the time is coming. Not that the Egyptians yet perceive it, but they are aware of the possibility that the Israelis could move all the way to the Nile and not merely Suez. And will go, the prophecy says, to the city that is called, you look in the margin in the Hebrew, it clearly would indicate that it is the city of On or Heliopolis, the city of the sun or of Heres, as the Egyptians had it. And it's a time when this area is going to be Hebrew speaking. And at that day there shall be an altar to the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, a pillar at the border. It's going to be for a sign and a witness to the Lord in the land of Egypt, for they shall cry to the Lord because of the oppressors, and he shall send them a Savior and a great one, and he shall deliver them. So it is a time in which a part of the land of Egypt has passed to Judah, and a time in which the Egyptians are going to ask God for help. And God will intervene and deliver them from a fierce king, verse 4, who's going to rule over them. And the Lord shall be known to Egypt, and the Egyptians shall know the Lord in that day. Not merely Allah, but they will understand that their idea of God as Allah, which is an Arabic form of Eloah or Elohim, is so different from the real God, who is the God of the Jews. And the Egyptians will know the Lord in that day, and shall do sacrifice and oblation, and they will vow a vow to the Lord and perform it. So you see, the Lord will smite Egypt with that fierce ruler, and in smiting it, he will also here heal it. And also, this could be parallel with chapter 14 of Zechariah, that if they perform it and then neglect to, God will smite them and then heal them because they will finally perform it. And they shall return to the Lord, and he shall be entreated of them and shall heal them. So verse 22 seems to be a direct parallel that when the Egyptians come first to do God's will and perform it, then they renege. And then they're struck with a plague. And then God heals them. And they seek God's help. and he heals them. And without any question, they will perform it. And that's the day which ultimately ends up in the three verses I read, verses 23 to 25 at the beginning. You might like to put this with Psalm 68:31, which I'll turn to just quickly here. Psalm 68:31. Princes shall come out of Egypt. Ethiopia shall soon stretch out her hands to God. Sing to God, you kingdoms of the earth, sing praises to the Lord. Now, you see, the Bible is talking about the ultimate good news that is going to come out of it. But the tragedy is that in the meantime, Egypt is going to be filled with advisors and counselors who will do everything that will ultimately precipitate the problem on all the Middle East. A struggle between the South, which is the OPEC nations, and the North, which today has the economic form of the common market. And the struggle will involve the use of oil as a weapon to force the North to take action, because there was nothing that could be done to the Carter or succeeding administrations that would force the United States to force Israel to relinquish territory. The fact that there is a struggle between the North and the South in Daniel chapter 11 at the crisis at the close implies that the praise and honor heaped on the President of the United States in the attempt by Sadat will fail. That we will not be able to force the Israelis to give up all that the Arabs want, and they will finally try to force the Europeans to do it. Not the Russians, the Europeans, the successor of Nebuchadnezzar's realm, the final revival of a Roman political empire. Today we only have an economic one. So we see that what is here today is only a prelude of some very bad news before the good news which Isaiah 19 ultimately alludes to. And in the meantime, of course, you have any number of years not stated in Scripture before this crisis at the close, which will lead to an ultimate tribulation that involves politics, oil, and religion. But all we can say is that at the moment, this is the day of the United States. The day in which Europe is going to play a role is coming later. And apparently, there's going to be oil as a weapon. There's no use to use oil as a weapon now against the United States and Europe because it won't work. That is the advice of the king of, or the ruler of Iran. But it can work later because we are not solving our problems. Now, how soon the Arabs would have to move remains to be seen on the basis of what we do with our supplies. I am not proposing any timetable. I would only say that this is a straw in the wind. It is a hoped-for sign that will unfortunately not succeed because the United States cannot pressure the Israelis. There are too many Jewish voters in this country that could turn any president out of office. And he cannot afford to do that. Besides, we have cultural links very heavy with Israel. So many things yet are to transpire. And even after the crisis between North and South, ultimately, apparently, a leader in the North, the king of the North, is going to dominate and rule in Egypt fiercely. And God will intervene and deliver them during a time in which the Jews and the king of the North have been struggling in the Middle East. So I would perceive that probably those five cities of importance east of the Nile, north of Cairo,
passed to the Jews at a time when the Middle East is in a state of turmoil, in which Egypt is dominated by one people and the Israelis are moving against the people who dominate Egypt. This would seem to be the picture of the story. And God delivers the Israelis, and the people of Egypt are also going to be delivered if they trust and seek God. That's what's indicated. They start out doing what's right, and then they decide to backtrack. And God has to deal with them and plague them until they are healed and come to their real senses. That would seem to be the implication of the story of Isaiah 19. It would be worth your time to read any good background material in any of the leading newspapers or magazines. I think that it is something at this point in which writers of skill will give you some information that they might not otherwise have, and it will certainly bring you up to date. And I think that we will see, of course, even in our own publications, information that should explain some of the background material. I hope this evening on television, for those of you who use it, that's everybody, that there will be some good material on the news. And please go through some of the other sections of the Bible pertaining to this in terms of the long-range prophecies, especially in Ezekiel as well.